This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, how is the coronavirus pandemic playing out in Latin America? Hello again, I'm Carol Castillo. A few weeks ago, we focused on the pandemic's effect on Africa, but what about America's neighbors to the south? The delay in the pandemic's arrival from Europe and Asia gave the continent valuable time to prepare, but many countries have not taken advantage of the advance warning. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro continues to play down the threat, undermining his own government's efforts to contain the virus. According to the Global Health Network, Brazil has more than 25,000 cases of COVID-19, the largest number on the continent. On the other hand, even though Ecuador acted swiftly to contain the virus by suspending large events and shutting down schools in early March, COVID-19 struck with force. According to The Economist magazine, Guayaquil, the country's largest city, was so overwhelmed by cases that, quote, relatives dumped their loved ones' bodies in the sweltering streets, unquote. In addition to political leadership or lack thereof, analysts say that the strength and capacity of healthcare systems in Latin America will determine how well the region copes in the face of COVID-19. Moreover, health systems vary greatly both between countries and within them. For example, one can find top-notch urban hospitals and dilapidated rural clinics within the same country. Grievances about inequality, which drew millions of protesters onto the streets of many Latin American countries last year, may only sharpen during the pandemic, but such complaints will likely simmer because directives to maintain social distancing will prevent protesters from going to the streets. In Venezuela, the response to the pandemic is complicated by the country's political stalemate. Nicolas Maduro claimed the presidency in an election that was widely viewed as fraudulent. He is using the crisis to demonstrate his de facto control of the country. Meantime, opposition leader Juan Guaido is recognized by the United States and more than 50 other nations as its rightful leader. More than 5 million Venezuelans, a sixth of the population, have fled poverty, hunger, and disease in recent years. Many economies in Latin America are also dependent on informal sectors, which will likely be hammered as a result of social distancing measures and lack of government subsidies to these communities. Well, with us to discuss the economic, health, and political impact of the coronavirus pandemic on Latin America are two distinguished regional analysts. Eric Farnsworth is vice president of the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society, and that's a leading voice on Western Hemisphere affairs here in Washington. And Eric Langer, he's professor of history at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University here in Washington. He teaches courses about Latin American history and indigenous movements. And both gentlemen join me via Skype as we all continue to practice social distancing. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. It's good to be back.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you both. Let me start with Eric Farnsworth. Eric, quickly, what are your overall observations regarding the pandemic on the continent? Which countries are hotspots? Which countries are doing better in dealing with the pandemic?
Well, I think that the pandemic caught much of Latin America and the Caribbean flat-footed. There was a real hope that the pandemic would not be as serious as it has been elsewhere in the region, particularly because of this idea that perhaps hot weather or warmer weather would slow down the spread. Now, we haven't seen that necessarily in reality. And because of that, steps were not taken perhaps prudentially that should have been. Having said that, there are some relative success stories. Peru, Chile acted swiftly. Argentina actually acted swiftly to try to control the spread early on. You've mentioned other countries that haven't. Ecuador in particular has been hit pretty hard. This was already going to be a difficult year for Latin America economically. The World Bank was already projecting slower growth up to maybe 2%, but probably not even that. And with the coronavirus now, you have the real prospects of one of the deepest recessions across the region, perhaps in the last half century. So it's going to be a difficult year.
Eric Langer, how do you characterize the impact of the pandemic on the hemisphere and the various responses we've seen so far?
As Eric Farnsworth said, it's really variable. But I think something that's quite clear is that the economic impact is going to be devastating. for Latin America. It will vary to a certain extent. I think places like Panama, which have much more to do with financial services than exports, probably will emerge somewhat unscathed. But other places such as Mexico, Brazil, and perhaps Chile and Argentina, which all rely so heavily on exports, will really be hit very hard. And obviously Ecuador as well, for reasons unknown. And in fact, what's so interesting is that the place where the apparent, at least the visual effect, and I know we're on radio here, has been greatest, as you mentioned, was in Ecuador. And in the hottest place in Ecuador, in fact, Guayaquil, which is a tropical port city. And so the hope that we had that coronavirus would somehow respect the seasons appears not to be the case.
Back to you, Eric Farnsworth. Quickly, do you know much about the testing in the continent? Is there a massive testing, which we know is a key element to opening up economies because the continent's being hit in such a devastating way?
Yeah, again, it varies from country to country and even regions within countries. But broadly speaking, testing across the region is underwhelming at this point.
Underwhelming. And speaking of regions, Eric, is there any type of regional coordination? For example, the Andean states, maybe the Northern Triangle states. Do you know much about that, or is it really country by country?
This is a key question, Carol, that you just hit on. You would hope, you would think that there would be real coordination across the region within sub-regions, that it would be coordinated perhaps by PAHO, the Pan-American Health Organization, or maybe the United States, or maybe a country in South America. But to this point, we really haven't seen that. We've seen a lot of people calling for regional coordination, a lot of people lamenting that it's not occurring. But the reality is it's not occurring. And, you know, most countries, of course, at this point are just wrapped up in their own domestic crises, trying to figure it out on their own. But I think this is a key learning that all of us are going to come away from this crisis with, is that regional coordination of pandemics, just like we've had to learn in terms of humanitarian crises and natural disasters, is really something that needs to be strengthened.
Eric Langer.
I think Eric Farnsworth is absolutely correct on that. But I think what this really shows is that the natural leaders of the region, whether it be Mexico, whether it be Brazil, who you could argue are probably within their regions, say Central America, etc., and then South America, have just simply not stepped up, and in part because of the kind of leadership that they have. I think we're living a particular moment in certainly Western Hemisphere history where the leaders who are in power look inward much more than outward and looking towards international integration. And so as a result, the Western Hemisphere, I think, as a whole, has really fallen down on the job where there could have been some natural leadership here, but simply it hasn't occurred.
Well, speaking of leadership or lack thereof, Eric Farnsworth, let's turn to Brazil. I mean, we're seeing President Jair Bolsonaro to this day playing down the pandemic. On the other hand, governors, certain states in Brazil are really stepping up to the plate, something like we're seeing here in the United States. Governors are way ahead of the game, sometimes more so than our own federal government. We also have one more parallel I'd like to make, and that is presumably the health minister, Henrique Mandetta, is considered Brazil's Anthony Fauci. And if we know, of course, Anthony Fauci here, I think the world has heard about him. He is one of our top health experts, and many look to him as opposed to some of our political leaders. What kind of impact is this having in Brazil, and political impact, particularly on Bolsonaro? He wants to ramp up the economy. He wants to be in denial because his plans were having some effect, but that's maybe hurting him now. And even his political fortunes.
There are some similarities, at least on the surface, between Brazil and the United States. Both of us have federal systems, state governments that are led by independent governors. And we are seeing a divergence in Brazil between the federal level and the state level. I think that's quite right. And each state is going to evaluate based on its own perceived interests. You know, the power of example is really powerful in a national crisis, and national leadership is powerful. I mean, people look to the leader of the country to set an example, to set a tone, to have empathy for people who may be hurting. And so it's too early to say at this point how this might play out politically in Brazil. You know, the elections just occurred a short while ago, about a year and a half ago. So, you know, the election cycle still has a ways to run before the president would seek re-election. But there is something to be said for how a leader reacts during a national crisis, and the voters do remember that.
Eric Langer, anything to add or subtract on Brazil?
Well, actually, I'd like to contrast it to Peru, where Martin Vizcarra, who was president of Peru, acted decisively right in the beginning. He got testing kits. There are more people being tested in Peru than virtually any other country within Latin America and even the United States. So that's admirable. And his approval rating shot up to 87%, which is highly unusual for any Latin American leader, because usually what happens is that within a year or two, and he's kind of past the 1 year mark at this point, you know, declines to about the 20s. And so here I think we have some real clear differences, and also where you can see the political consequences, where Bolsonaro is just not hitting it off. There, in fact, was a viral video of Bolsonaro speaking, and you could actually see the spit leaving from his mouth, which was pretty disgusting. But people said, ooh, you know, this is not very good. And, you know, how can he be doing this and all of that? And others clearly have stepped up to the plate and done that. But precisely as we talked about in the beginning, you know, this is so variable where this happened. But I think Peru is here the one, if you will, best example, and probably to say that things have been done as they must be, because something, and we can talk about this, and this is certainly in the case in Brazil as well, is that the informal economy is such a large part of most countries' economy. And of course, most people live hand to mouth. And so all of these restrictions are really, really hurting people. And it also makes it incredibly difficult to enforce other than large cities.
Let's talk about that on the other side of our break. First, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. My guests are Eric Farnsworth. He's vice president of the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society, and Eric Langer, from whom you just heard, professor of history at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, an expert in Latin America. And they both join me via Skype, and we're discussing the implications of the coronavirus pandemic on Latin America. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Ayuba Inua from Bauchi State in Nigeria. Folks from Latin America, I'm waiting to hear from you. Okay. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send me an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And of course, more than ever, as we all confront the pandemic, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us how you're coping. Well, back to our guests, and let's pick up on where we left off, where Eric Langer talked about the informal economy. So first to you, Eric Farnsworth, talk about the fact that the informal economy is such a large part of the economic landscape in Latin America, and how much more difficult it's going to make fighting the pandemic and getting the continent back on track in terms of economic growth.
Yeah, I'm so glad that Dr. Langer brought this into the conversation, because it's absolutely right. It'll affect some countries more than others, but every country is going to be impacted by these particular issues. Look, if you are in the formal economy, more or less, you probably have access to salary, maybe healthcare, maybe a pension. It may not be adequate. It might not be as much as you want, but there's some sort of social safety net, perhaps, that can help you and your family. And so if the government instructs you to stay home for a period of time, it's going to not be fun. You won't like it, probably, but you can survive. If you're in the informal economy, selling trinkets or food or fruit and vegetables or something on the street corner, or living hand to mouth, you literally have to make your income day to day. And if you skip days, your family sometimes doesn't eat. And so people don't really have the option of social distancing, of staying at home, of not working, because they don't have a social safety net to rely on. They don't have a savings account. So this is a real problem. And one thing, Carol, that you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, I want to come back to, and that is that listeners who were tuning in at the end of last year would remember that there were a lot of protests going on across the region, you know, and much of that was because of limited ability of governments to meet expectations of their citizens for adequate health care and education and schooling and such things. If you take that and now amplify it, as the coronavirus is doing, and exposing the inability of many governments to actually meet basic needs of large percentages of their population, we can anticipate date, perhaps it won't happen, but we can anticipate nonetheless, that some of these trends that were evident at the end of last year could reestablish themselves across the region with greater intensity. So I think that's something that we're going to have to watch, even as the economies of the region struggle and you don't have that fallback in terms of economic growth, job creation, and the ability to really see people's incomes and lives improving.
Eric Langer, talk some more about the informal economy and how it is an impediment to both preventing the spread of the coronavirus pandemic and also strengthening the economies which have been battered as it is.
Clearly, the informal economy makes it so much more difficult. And also, I think the control of the state tends to be very weak, actually, outside of capital cities. Obviously, it varies a lot. Argentina, say, much greater. Chile is certainly probably the best. Costa Rica, but then you go into the countryside, say, in Peru, or Bolivia, or say in the countryside in northern Mexico, where you have drug cartels and things like that. So that's a whole nother issue. For example, gangs in the favelas of Brazil are also establishing their own policies on social distancing and things like that, and are already substituting the state. Now, whether that's good or bad is something we really have to think about, because for one, the social distancing in itself is good, but COVID-19 really shows the great weaknesses of all of our states, not just in Latin America, but in the developed world as well. And so human beings come up with substitute systems. And obviously what matters is also where the power is located. Then you have El Salvador, where you have Nayib Bukele, and who has been trying to take over the government and basically rule as authoritarian, is using this opportunity, and he had tried before but failed, to just basically grab power and rule. And so that certainly occurs as well in some cases. The other thing that I want to bring in that also has to do with the informal economy is the Venezuelan refugees. They are up the creek without a paddle. When I was in Peru not that long ago, I saw basically live on the street and they're begging on the street. Now, first of all, the streets are empty and the police beat them off the streets. Don't know where they stay, but the folks that I saw there were so incredibly thin and malnourished already. And obviously they don't fit within the national economy. They don't have identity cards. There's no way in which they are officially counted in many ways. And so they're the ones who are suffering even more. And in fact, some have actually returned to Venezuela, though I suspect that it doesn't really matter where they are right now. They're just really, really in bad shape. So we have certain sectors of the population which is worse off than others. And then we see where the power really lies in Latin America right here. Also, by the way, in Michoacán, in Mexico, for example, it looks like, I love the name of this gang, Los Viagras. Have basically taken over and have said, okay, we're going to have social distancing and, you know, you have to stay in house and we're going to kill you. And so there are different ways of doing this, but it's really interesting to see from a social science perspective. But obviously what I'm really talking about is a lot of human suffering as well.
Well, back to you, Eric Farnsworth. I wanted to bring up Venezuela, so I'm thanking Eric for having done so, particularly within the context of the refugees. Obviously, Maduro is trying to assert himself. He did act quickly to impose a lockdown. But again, it's against this backdrop of crumbling hospitals, even washing hands is a luxury, little clean water, soap. And then, of course, the migrants. I mean, it's just heartbreaking. I was actually in Manaus, Brazil, and I saw them there. This was before the pandemic crisis. How do you see the plight of the refugees? What can be done to protect them? I mean, it's like they're between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, this is a huge tragedy at the human level, at the political level. Even before coronavirus, I was routinely describing the Venezuela situation as the worst humanitarian crisis in the modern history of Latin America. Things have only gotten worse. It's really hard, not to say impossible, to combat a highly contagious virus if you don't have access to clean water and soap, much less ventilators and, you know, all the things that we might have available in societies whose healthcare systems have not collapsed. Now, you know, the ruling regime in Venezuela has access to all of these things, but the Venezuelan people do not. The question is, what can be done? A lot can be done. A huge amount could be done within Venezuela itself if Mr. Maduro would allow the international community to bring humanitarian assistance into the country, but he refuses to do it unless he's able to control it. And that would obviously strengthen his position in the country, as well as, you know, most donors don't believe that any aid that they would give to Venezuela through the Maduro regime would actually be delivered to anybody except his cronies, and it would be stolen and corrupted. Meanwhile, the Venezuelan people are suffering. So that's a real problem. But, you know, given the fact that there are 5 to 6 million Venezuelans outside the country already, as Eric Langer has already said, I think that those folks also have to be very much looked after, have to have access to basic health care services. And it's not an issue of we're doing this because it's good for them. We're doing this because it's good for all of us. A pandemic doesn't care if you're rich or poor, refugee, ruling class. It doesn't care. And so if you can't stop it in a mobile population, which is not social distancing, which is moving all across the region, then you've got some real problems.
Well, speaking of that, Eric Langer, what about the role of PAHO? Could they play a role in this regard vis-a-vis the migrants and maybe coordinating strategies on the continent to prevent the spread of the virus? And what is their relationship to the World Health Organization?
They're a subsidiary of the World Health Organization, but this is where the problem lies. PAHO is an organization which can only advise. Their member states who belong to PAHO are sovereign entities. So they can only advise different governments to do things. They might be able to coordinate, but as Eric Farnsworth said earlier, nobody's coordinating right now. Everybody's closing their borders, not really doing anything together. And in fact, one thing that we actually know is that closing borders isn't actually the most effective thing to do in the first place. So the lack of coordination among them, and once borders are closed, you know, who cares what happens in the neighboring country if you have the border closed? You just have to worry about your own stuff. That, especially with refugee crises and things like that, as is occurring with the Venezuelan, is totally ineffective. So PAHO could take a role, but they have to be invited in.
All right. And of course, PAHO, I meant Pan American Health Organization. Back to you, Eric Farnsworth. What about the recent action by the Department of Justice indicting Nicolas Maduro and members of his inner circle on drug charges? He was formerly labeled a criminal. Does this help or hurt our cause for a democratic Venezuela?
Well, you know, they say in politics, timing is everything. And they also say optics matter. But it certainly has changed the situation on the ground in Venezuela, at least in terms of the calculus of some of the leaders of the Venezuelan regime who now are under indictment. And that has already begun to change some of their behavior. Not to say that Venezuela is like Panama in any particular way, but there is something that occurred in the 1980s with the indictment of then leader Manuel Noriega of Panama. And we know how that ended. I don't suggest that the same is on tap for Venezuela. But once you indict somebody at that level in any country, it really does change the politics around the issue. There's no question about that.
Eric Langer, I'd like you to weigh in on that, what this means. Could this be a positive move by the United States to precipitate a change and give Juan Guaido a leg up?
Potentially and potentially not. The problem is that Juan Guaido's real strength has been the ability to mobilize on the ground. Now, to a certain extent, that has diminished anyway. But obviously, in a pandemic, you don't want to have a whole bunch of people coming together and running down the street and waving flags and chanting slogans and things like that. So in that sense, I think everything has kind of been put on the deep freeze, just like the economy. I think what will be really, really interesting to see is what happens once restrictions get lifted. In other words, we're going to have the whole world in partial economic ruins. And the question is, who comes out of the ashes and who is able to survive there? It seems to me that as a principle, those leaders have support of their populations will do better than others. Maduro is much less popular than Juan Guaido. And so presumably that will help Guaido. And maybe at that point, Maduro's just going to say, forget it, I can't do this anymore and leave. But we just don't know.
That's just about all the time we have on this Latin American edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Americas Society and the Council of the Americas, and Eric Langer, Professor of History at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Gracias, gentlemen, as always, for your terrific insights. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.